Welcome to The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Fred Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Fred Crouch.
A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Dom Carrillo, and supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Carolyn Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for the wonderful effort. Bernie, how about a recap from the previous podcast when we discussed Ontario's Landlord and Tenant Board, the good, the bad, and the ugly? Any thoughts?
If you're a tenant, you're worried that your landlord's going to cause you harm. And if you're a landlord, you're worried your tenant's going to cause you harm. And you can't shake it off. But I think the key out of that whole message was good communications. That was the absolute key. You know, if you're going to vet the person, you got to talk to them. And if they have ongoing problems with the place, talk to them. And, you know, if things have to change in their life, you talk with them, right? If you have good communications, you have a good chance of fixing a problem. Even if you end up going to the tenant board for an issue, sometimes you can resolve that ahead of time. And I don't think the tenant board minds. They're not paid by a case per se. If something resolves and everybody's amicable about it, go for it.
Yeah, I think that was the overwhelming message that Ian tried to educate or suggest, that communication was key. And that sometimes it was well worthwhile to have direct dialogue with your tenant or your landlord, whatever the case may be, to resolve the issue much quicker. Because the delays he was speaking about and the cost to landlords in situations where the tenant refuses or hasn't paid rent can be astronomical. So we all hope that doesn't happen to any of our listeners. But if you haven't listened to it, please go back and listen to the good, the bad, and the ugly. Take care. Wonderful. You've got mail. Welcome back, wizards. Today, we're going to clean up some of the questions which didn't make it to any of our podcast episodes in season 4. Most of these are quick and easy. Bernie, take it away.
Certainly, Fred. First one is Amelia Zoppa from Santa Barbara. And she writes down, really enjoy your podcast. I was wondering when it was you started investing and buying real estate yourself.
Great question. I love talking about my real estate investments, the good, the bad, and the ugly. Amelia, thank you for the question. I bought my first property back in 1978. It was a 2-bedroom condominium apartment. And within 6 months of that initial purchase, I bought 2 other properties, both rooming houses. So it was like baptism by fire. I had no idea what was involved in managing or owning a rooming house. And I bought those within a block of Ottawa's at the time bustling bus terminal, which is no longer there, but it was a colorful area to say the least. The rest is history. Thank you for the question, Amelia.
Our next one coming up is Jason McGregor from Windsor, Ontario. And he writes, you talk about how to use the IVR formula to establish value. He gets the V relates to value and that the R relates to the cap rate. But does the I relate to net operating income or gross income?
Thank you for your question, Jason. And it's a good question. A lot of people kind of stumble over that. To those people, I strongly suggest you maybe sign up for our course. We've got a great little segment just dealing with the IVR formula. But the Coles notes, at the end of the day, the I relates to the net operating income. And for a refresher, net income is the gross scheduled income, less operating expenses, but before allowances for debt service, depreciation, or personal income taxes. The beauty of using the IVR formula is that it allows you to compare rates of return on properties that may not necessarily be of the same type. So what we're saying here is that it allows you to compare, say, a multi-unit residential building with the rate of return of, let's say, a strip plaza or some sort of commercial building. So it's dealing strictly with the return on your investment. It doesn't matter what type of real estate holding it is. So thank you for your question. And sign up for that course. I think you'll learn a lot. Thank you, Jason.
Martin White from Kamloops, British Columbia, says, hey, he's fast approaching 60 years of age, and he's wondering if you feel it might be a little late for him to start investing in real estate.
Oh, my God, bite your tongue, Martin. Really, 60's still very young. Bottom line is, my short answer to your question is not at all. People invest in real estate for a variety of reasons. Yes, it's easier to build and expand your real estate portfolio the earlier you start. However, starting a little later also affords you the benefit of having more assets from which to draw from. All that's meaning to say is that the older you are, chances are you've accumulated much or many more assets than you had when you were, let's say, a teenager or in your 20s. So it can make it easier for you. By starting a little later, you may not be counting on your real estate investment to provide you with income in your retirement, but what it will do is create a good platform for building generational wealth. And how many times, Bernie, have we come and discussed generational wealth? You know, you don't necessarily do it for yourself, but you can do it for your family and for your kids. So keep that in mind. Martin, it's never too late. Thank you for your question.
Yeah, it's also a good investment vehicle. Our next one is from overseas, and it's from Eleanor Hushon from Ilford, England. The question posed is, real estate prices are such here in the UK that it's almost impossible to purchase buy-to-let property. What is your suggestion for someone entertaining such a purchase?
For our listeners who are not familiar with the term buy-to-let, it's an English term covering income properties or rental properties. So they refer to it very often as buy-to-let property. Thank you, Eleanor, for your question. No doubt about it, real estate prices within the United Kingdom are high when compared to other markets, but they do not present an insurmountable problem. Unless you have inherited wealth or other assets from which to draw from, coming up with a down payment sizable enough to purchase an investment property can be a daunting task. This problem is not just limited to the UK. It's worldwide, even here in North America, more specifically, even here in Canada. The best suggestion that I have for you would be to get yourself involved with a group of like-minded individuals, combine your available down payments, and purchase a property together as a co-tenancy group. There are many advantages to purchasing real estate in this manner. To find out more about co-tenancies, please listen to Season 1, Episode 9 of The Property Wizard. We dedicated that entire podcast to co-tenancies. Seems like so long ago, Bernie, doesn't it?
Yeah, just a bit of time. But you know what? It's funny you brought up co-tenancies. So we have Jody Dufour from Brampton. She's a fan. She loves the podcast, and she's learned a lot. But now she's got a question, and it's about co-tenancy. She's looking to find out who usually makes the decision when it comes to a co-tenancy purchase.
Great question. Thank you for it, Jody. This is really, really great to hear another question relating to co-tenancies. It just shows you how very popular this particular investment strategy has become, and with good reason. Jody, co-tenancies are meant to be democratic in nature, meaning that a majority vote of the participants carries the decision. Usually, however, a co-tenancy group will appoint either an individual or perhaps two, maybe three of their group to make decisions on behalf of the other participants up to a set dollar amount. So usually what happens is that the actual co-tenancy agreement will stipulate that whoever your representatives are may spend up to X number of dollars. It's never a considerable amount. I've seen them where it's $500. I've seen them where they're $5,000. So it all depends on the comfort level. And of course, it depends on the type of property it is as well. This streamlines the management process, but leaves major decisions, such as those involving expenditures above the set limit and those involving the purchase, sale, or leasing of the property, up to the group as a whole. The other thing that you could do is hire a management company to run the day-to-day operations of your investment. Again, most management contracts will stipulate a set dollar amount that the management company may spend without having to present back to the group in its entirety. I hope that helps.
Fred, that's the last thing in the mailbag. So I guess to our audience, if you have any questions, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. And of course, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Wizards, it's Fraud Prevention Month here in Ontario, so we're dedicating this entire episode of the Property Wizard to a topic which, for all the wrong reasons, is constantly in the news: real estate fraud. Just listen to some of these headlines. Real estate investor guilty on 27 counts of fraud. Three victims had been issued promissory notes for the same unit. This is not paraphrasing or taking the headline from one example. These are different examples, listeners. Real estate investor who swindled friends has a greed issue. Warrants issued in Ontario scam that defrauded people of their homes. Rental guarantees not worth the paper they're written on. This one I found surprising. Daughter's mortgage fraud on her parents' house shines a light on the need for homeowner title insurance, and we're going to be talking a great deal about that. Another headline reads, lost their life savings to a con artist. So, how much of instances of real estate-related fraud increased? Well, in California alone, phishing emails involving real estate fraud have increased from less than $9 million in 2015. Even $9 million sounds like an incredible amount. But today, in real terms, and this isn't even necessarily completely up to date, it's gone from $9 million in 2015 to over $446 million in 2024. And that's just one form of illicit activity. There are an entire host of others. And we're going to be discussing, you know, many more than identity theft and fake listings and rental scams and predatory lenders and lawyers who maybe don't hold true to their creed. The bottom line is this: if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Check out the new course offerings at gentrylearning.com. There you'll find answers to all your real estate investment questions. Divided into easy-to-learn interactive segments, it's the affordable way to gain invaluable insight and knowledge into the world of real estate investing. Start the right way. Visit gentrylearning.com.
Listeners, we are pleased to once again introduce to you our returning guest, Mark Habib. Mark has been a lawyer in Ottawa for 36 years. He is with the law firm of Habib & Associates, where he practices primarily residential and commercial real estate. Mark is a past trustee and the current chair of the County of Carleton Law Association, or CCLA, Real Estate Lawyers Committee, which oversees legal issues affecting the local real estate bar. Amazing to have you back here, Mark. You're such a wealth of knowledge, and this is right up your alley. So thank you again for agreeing to be on the podcast again. Nice to have you back.
Thanks so much, Fred. It's a pleasure to be back here on your podcast and to have a talk about a very interesting subject for your listeners. And I've been looking forward to it.
Mark, what type of frauds are being perpetrated out there? I mean, we see stuff in the news, right? And, you know, someone is scammed out of, and then off goes the story. But knowing the type of frauds that are out there is half the battle, understanding what to look for. What are you finding out there right now from the real estate perspective for frauds?
That's a good question. We're seeing frauds not just in real estate, as you know. We see fraud in the financial and accounting sectors. We're seeing it in business transactions. We're seeing it in the employment context. And of course, we are seeing it in the real estate sector as well. and largely centered around the issue of identity theft. What we're seeing, of course, is that technology is changing so rapidly that the fraudsters are so advanced in perpetrating these frauds that the law is very slow to respond in an effective way. We now have even issues with, you know, cryptocurrency is now entering the fray. Nobody knows how to quite deal with it. And it's not allowed yet, but it's coming. And how is that going to impact transactions? We're going to see situations now with AI facilitating frauds. A case just came up the other day where on a video conference between a mortgage broker, was a broker or the lawyer, I can't recall, the video of the individual borrower was actually a fake video of the individual in question. It was an AI-generated image based upon data that had been stolen. So these are kind of the types of situations that we're facing in an ever-changing environment. So we're here today to talk about some of these situations and perhaps how to deal with them.
Yeah, that's just incredible. I thank you for sending me over the link to that webinar. I actually listened to it too, and I was fascinated by how sophisticated these frauds have become. I mean, amazing. Can you imagine having a face-to-face or trying to verify someone's identity and without your knowledge, facing an AI-generated image of an individual speaking to you when that individual isn't, in fact, the person you're supposed to be speaking to? I mean, who would have imagined this even a couple of years ago? It was the material for Skunk Works and the Soviet Union and, cutting and pasting images in. Well, it's gotten a lot more sophisticated than that. So, Mark, in your opinion, is there a particular group or demographic that is most vulnerable to, certain types of fraud?
Well, I think we all probably recognize that seniors are probably the most vulnerable group in society, minors as well, and perhaps immigrants who are not as sophisticated with the ways of the world here in the West. But I think we're seeing now that almost everybody is vulnerable to becoming a victim of fraud. I'm even embarrassed, Fred, to tell you that I was a victim of fraud. I was applying for a loan a few years ago, and I was contacted by my bank saying that I had three outstanding liabilities on my credit bureau related to an automobile, a Ford F-150 that I purportedly had purchased and took a loan on, but it was not me. The fraudster had created a driver's license with all of my information, my birth date, my name, but the driver's license photo was this fraudster. And he walked into a car dealership in Kamloops, BC, purchased a Ford F-150. The salesman just did a credit check on my name with the ID in question, handed over the vehicle. And the next thing you know, my credit bureau was affected by a loan that I never took out. And it took some time to clean up. But this was a very innocuous type of situation. And it seemed so simple to me that somebody could do this just with a fake piece of one piece of ID, because that's the only piece that he produced was a driver's license.
Amazing. And not in a good way. And I, listeners, Mark does not drive a pickup truck, just to be crystal clear on that. There's no pickup truck in Mark's future. All right. So yeah, that is, thank you for sharing that. That is so true. I mean, even, we'll share something with you. Bernie and I have an acquaintance, not a close acquaintance, but, we have a pretty select group of people that we actually work with. And through Bernie, who was involved in a very minor way with this individual, he introduced him to me, and he was looking and talking about investing in real estate. And I took him out, and we had a number of different discussions. And then I went back to Bernie and I said, are you absolutely sure that this, this cat is he above board and everything? And I remember, Bernie, what you said. It's funny you should bring that up, because I just got notice about this, that, and the other thing. And anyways, this individual kind of, you know, came into the picture, then left the picture. And then a couple of days ago, Bernie, you sent me that that article about him, about how he was just, I guess, charged with, you know, absconding with, what was it, $260,000 or $80,000 in investors' funds for some failed real estate scam or whatever. I mean, it it's all over the place. And, you know, we're all, you know, professionals. We're out there. We're dealing with a number of people. So if they're coming and, Mark, if they're stealing your identity, which is pretty risky, I'd say, and when these people are crossing our paths, I won't say on a regular basis, but occasionally, I mean, it's just, it's out there. It's all over the place, all over the place. One of the titles of the, that I read during the introduction piece was actually another fraudster who actually approached me and wanted to discuss about co-tenancies. He made a specific request to meet me and sit down and discuss co-tenancies. I'm always happy to talk real estate, and I was happy to turn around and have that discussion with him. But before I did, and this is what I would suggest all our listeners do, before engaging with an individual that is about or wants to sell you something, or before engaging with most anyone you don't know firsthand, look them up. Do a Google search. Try to find out who they are in advance. There's nothing creepy about that, but the person that you may be protecting is yourself. In this particular instance, I very quickly found out that this guy had a bit of a colorful past, and I opened up the dialogue and the discourse we had over a coffee by saying, I don't know what I could possibly explain to you, you know, and I brought up the instances where, you know, he'd been involved with, and there were actual problems. And at the time, it didn't seem such a big deal. But that became a major headline here in Eastern Ontario. And he was eventually charged with overselling and oversubscribing a development. So much so, and this is where the headline came from, he would sell title or an interest in the real estate development to more than one person. In one case, you know, most of the titles, or most of the titles were actually encumbered with people that two, three, sometimes even four individuals had an interest in a specific unit, all the same unit. So, I mean, it's just ridiculous, absolutely ridiculous. But thank you for that point. Yeah. Thank you for sharing, Mark. It's all over the place. Now, I know we're at that world. So for many of our listeners, they're not going to be as involved as we are. But still, if we're exposed to it, listeners, you can too.
Fred, just to finish up on my situation, one thing that your listeners can do to protect themselves from the situation that I had was you can subscribe now to a service with Equifax or TransUnion or any of these credit bureaus that will notify, they'll send you an email or a text anytime somebody is running a credit check against your name. That is a very useful thing to have. I mean, it's some cost associated with that, but honestly, for the amount of protection it offers you from the type of problem that I had, which really messed me up for about a year, it's very valuable, a very valuable tool.
Yeah, great point. Great point, listeners. That's a golden nugget. Thank you again, Mark, for sharing. So, Mark, could you provide us with an example of an illicit transfer of title to a lot of people that don't quite understand the concept? And what I'm referencing is a transfer of title ownership of real property happening unbeknownst to the homeowner.
Yes. There's been a couple of incidents. Well, there's been several. Two that I'd like to highlight for you today. One occurred in Scarborough, Ontario, back in 2000. In that situation, a husband and wife had owned a property in their home that they lived in for many, many years. They didn't buy title insurance when they bought the home. Well, they probably bought it even before title insurance kind of came into Canada. But what happened was their daughter and their sister were able to obtain fake ID for them. And they went and transferred the title to themselves and put a new mortgage on that property, which they promptly absconded with. And then, of course, the bank went after the homeowner saying, you know, you haven't paid your mortgage. And then they proceeded to enforce that. And these folks almost lost their home. The homeowners had to, of course, retain a lawyer and spend thousands and thousands of dollars to rectify their title, including suing their daughter, suing the director of land title, suing the lender, the broker, the lawyer, anybody, everybody involved with that transaction. The point being that had these folks purchased title insurance, their title would have been fully protected against a fraud occurring anytime after they acquired the title. There are several title insurance companies operating in Canada. They all offer a very similar type of fraud coverage for identity theft. And even if somebody doesn't currently have a title insurance policy on their home, they can purchase an existing homeowner policy, you know, even several years, several decades after they originally purchased the home. There are a bit of searches that have to be done to verify certain information, but any real estate lawyer can assist them in obtaining that type of protection.
So what's the, Mark, sorry to interrupt, but what's the cost related to that? I know it's a one-time charge.
Yes. On a title insurance policy, there are three types of policies, really. A homeowner policy that's taken out at the time a home is purchased. And usually at that time, if they're getting a mortgage, the bank will also require that the mortgage be title insured by a lender title policy. And the purchaser is responsible to pay for the bank's policy as well. The premium is typically based upon the amount of the loan, both the amount of the purchase price as well as the amount of the loan. Typically, we're seeing it, the total cost being under $1,000. And as indicated, these are one-time costs, basically part and parcel of your legal fees at the time of closing. And as indicated, the third type of a policy is an existing homeowner policy, which is, again, based upon the current value of the home. And again, typically anywhere from $800 to $1,500 I'm seeing for those. I wanted to just briefly touch on another case that I learned about recently involving a fraud. And this one involved, again, a property in Ontario. It was, a $2 million property. The owners were foreigners. They happened to be Chinese. And they actually lived in Beijing. And they rented a property in Toronto to some tenants who were also Asian. These tenants went and got fake ID in the name of the landlords or their landlord, owner of the property, promptly went to a real estate agent, listed the home for sale. The home got sold. Again, they provided the fake ID to the lawyer acting on the sale, and they received all of the proceeds of the sale. And next thing you know, the people in China found out that they didn't actually own the home anymore.
Oh.
Fortunately, in that case, there was a title insurance policy in place. But what we're learning is that these title insurance companies are paying out huge claims on these types of things. So we as lawyers are now being bombarded with red flags that we should be on the look for and very high level identity verification and authentication processes that we have to follow to mitigate against these instances of fraud.
You know, I've gone through a mortgage renewal myself. Between the mortgage broker, the lender, and the lawyer, I've sent my passport to more people, and I haven't left the country yet. I get it. I understand it. So, you know, the due diligence piece. And in fact, an in-person meeting going, does the passport match you? So I appreciate that. I also understood about the mortgage title insurance, too. On that vein, though, what are the other type of real estate investment scams that are out there? What else, like, you know, we've talked about title insurance, you know, and, you know, having that. But, you know, Fred talked about another gent that we both knew, right? And he just basically did the beautiful song of the of my people and give me your money, right? And then, it, you know, to vaporware. What other type of investment scams are out there? I mean, obviously, I got a second one there, but.
Well, we do see situations where people are asked to lend money on real estate. So you have some money and you are approached by somebody to invest in a real estate project that has, you know, very high levels of returns, and you're perhaps, you know, sucked into information that just appears to be too good to be true. There's all kinds of risks and security issues related to this. You may be handing over money to people on the understanding that you're going to have a first mortgage on the property, only to find out that you're actually going to be third in line to get paid. So if you're an investor, you have to really, as Fred said, do your background checks on people, to ask around. Don't be afraid to voice any levels of concern, because the fact is, if it sounds too big to be true, it's probably not true. And you're looking to become the next victim of a fraudster.
Yeah, there's an awful lot of real huge. It amazes me how much money some of these individuals can actually raise. I mean, it's in the, $100,000 is a pretty minor fraud in general terms. To many of us, it would be considerable. It would be, you know, it's sizable. But I'm talking about in the millions of dollars. And how these people are able to raise that kind of money is beyond me. When you see the cut of their jib and the type of individuals they are, but yet they must be real sweet talkers, because they're absconding with tens, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in illicit rental schemes. And it goes on and on and on. But we're going to finish up this segment talking about some rules we should all be aware of. So thank you for that, Mark. That's a great intro. So you touched on it just briefly, Mark, but specifically, what are some red flags that may alert you to a real estate related scam or fraud?
Well, from a lawyer's perspective, we've been given a lot of guidance by our law society that regulates us to look out for certain red flags that can come up when we are contacted by a prospective client to handle a transaction. So I'll just run through a list of them and you'll get a sense of what it all kind of looks like. Typically, you're contacted by a new client. You haven't acted for this client before. He wants to purchase a property or sell a property. They may be acting, there's no other real estate agent or mortgage broker involved. It's a cash deal. They want you to act for both the buyer and the seller. It happens to be that the title to the property is completely clear. There's no mortgage on the property that's being dealt with. It's a quick transaction, as indicated. They want to do this. Everybody's in a rush. They're leaving for overseas. It needs to be done within a matter of days. We look at the title and we see from the title that there's been two or three transfers of that very property within a fairly short period of time at inflated prices. We see a number of mortgages that have been registered on the property, but then subsequently discharged in short order. We are told that it's impossible to meet with the clients in person. They prefer to just do it over the phone. They're not able to produce two pieces of government-issued photo ID. These are some of the kind of flags that kind of we're told to be very careful with and to be on the alert for when being asked to represent clients in these circumstances. And there's several more, but those are the kind of the main ones that jump out at me at this point.
That's incredible, Mark, when you think about it. And I don't know, you know, anytime that you're at a bank and you're making a deposit, it's now become common practice for the bank to ask you for your phone number. Well, that seems like, you know, a real minor inconvenience compared to, you know, basically the liability that you as a lawyer shoulder. I mean, yes. to take a look at all these varying factors. I mean, you have to have a checklist that's, you know, a legal page long, you know, to verify. And, you know, for it's a shame that you have to do it. But at the same time, you know, your clients, I'm sure if they understand the broad scheme of what's involved, I mean, would be most appreciative that you're taking the time to, you know, verify, you know, really for their benefit, right? That's who it benefits.
Well, really, the real estate lawyer is kind of the last line of defense. These situations, you know, the fraudster slips through, perhaps the mortgage broker and the bank, they slip through an unsuspecting party involved in the transaction, such as a buyer or seller. And you're kind of the last line of defense. What's happened now, particularly since COVID, is that rules have opened up. It used to be that lawyers in Ontario were not allowed to meet with clients virtually to sign documents. We weren't allowed to use DocuSign or, you know, the public sign.
Yep, sure.
The remote signing of legal documents. We had to meet with the clients in person. But of course, with the pandemic, things changed, and they changed rather rapidly. You know, lawyers always thought for many years, it's too bad that we couldn't do it. So when the rules came in that said we could do it, many people were happy about it. But at the same time, it's opened the door to the opportunity for frauds to occur. And as I pointed out in my opening remarks, if now when I'm doing a video call with somebody, how do I know that that's actually the client? How do I know that's the real individual who owns the property? How am I supposed to verify that? I shared with you some new technology that has come out, a company called Treefort Technologies. They are actually owned by a title insurance company here in Canada. And this technology company offers a service to authenticate the client's identification. So effectively, Fred, I would tell you, I'm going to meet with you on Zoom to sign these documents in DocuSign, and I'm going to explain the documents to you, and you can sign them and I'll witness them. But to make sure you are you, we're going to send you a link. You're going to have to hold up your passport to your cell phone, and the cell phone will take a picture of your ID, and through the technology, it will be able to authenticate that it is, in fact, a valid piece of ID. So this is one of the tools that have come out to mitigate against these instances of fraud. It's a valuable tool, particularly since more and more people now, they're working remotely. They don't want to come to your office. They want the technology to and the ability to use technology to facilitate their real estate transaction. But as you pointed out, there's all kinds of risks associated with this.
Absolutely.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned the passport and the phone. Canada Post has a product out there. You just bring the phone. It's not shielded up against your passport, and it reads the passport with the app, and it populates. And so I find that interesting. And it was an interesting exercise, and just it was something I went through just recently.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds great. But, you know, before long, some fraudster, some is going to figure out a way around it. And we'll be dealing with a different type of situation because these guys are always one step ahead.
Yeah, it's just incredible. Everyone applauds the introduction of AI and everything that it's allowed us to do. But there's always a negative. There's always going to be a player out there that wants to take advantage of it for nefarious reasons or purposes. And we constantly need to be on guard. So how common is title fraud? I mean, you know, in the general scheme of things, I mean, we're talking a great deal about it, but, and it comes in many and various forms, but how common is it?
Fred, it's so common now that, as I pointed out, the title insurance companies have been paying out millions and millions and millions of dollars on claims to the point where they are so on top of requiring their lawyers on these deals to jump through hoops to make sure that there's no fraud involved in a transaction. In some cases, they won't insure a property if certain criteria aren't satisfied. I don't have actual numbers. I should have checked, but in terms of the amount of claims that are paid out, I can find out that information and share it with you later, Fred.
Wonderful. Thank you for that, Mark. No doubt it's increased dramatically over the past few years.
Definitely.
You know, again, it was a rarity to hear of a real estate related fraud. You know, when I say a rarity, I mean, everyone was aware that it occurred or happened, but there always seemed to be, you know, underlying circumstances why it was allowed to perpetuate or why it occurred. But today, I mean, you have a complete gamut of different players and characters and schemes that seem to be out there. Bernie, number seven.
Section 118 of the Land Titles Act. I'm going to assume that's a provincial legislation. How does that help the property owner avoid being the next victim of title fraud?
So Section 118 of the Land Titles Act is a law of Ontario. It governs land use in Ontario. And what this section allows for is for a homeowner to register with the Land Titles Office a caution on their own property that would basically result in a no dealings indicator being placed on the land, such that it's like a flag being put out there to anybody who wants to transfer the title or register a mortgage on the title to indicate that you cannot deal with this land unless certain third party consent is obtained to dealing with the land. It's not a complete, it doesn't, registering one of these doesn't completely bar you from the ability to transfer the land or mortgage the land, but it does put out that caution. So if you're a lawyer and you're about to do a transaction and this pops up, you'll be on the alert and you'll want to make sure that the required consent is obtained from either the existing homeowner or perhaps the homeowner appointed a third party like a child to be the person that has to give the consent to having that caution lifted off the land. So it's not a perfect tool, but it's just one of the tools in a lawyer's toolbox to protect a homeowner from them becoming a victim of fraud and avoiding a situation that I described earlier where the land could be transferred away from under you without your knowledge.
So speaking specifically of that act, does it serve the same purpose as, for instance, when a homeowner acquires title insurance, whether it's a lender's policy or homeowner's policy? Is there a notice placed on title that this insurance exists? Or is it a requirement from the firm that's providing the insurance?
No, the Section 118 notation on the title is placed by the lawyer. It has nothing to do with the title insurance company.
Okay.
It's simply a step that a lawyer would take at the request of the homeowner. Just, you know, they may have come to you and say, or maybe there's an elderly person, or maybe the child of an elderly is worried. Look, my dad's in his 90s. I'm worried that, you know, somebody's going to take advantage of him and sell the home from under him. We want you to register this on the land so that I will be notified, or dad will be notified anytime anybody's going to come and arrest. It's similar to the thing I was telling you about with a credit bureau check, you know, where somebody's going to apply for a loan on you and they'll do a credit check. Well, and you get a notification of it. This would be a kind of the similar type of precaution that's available to use with respect to land.
Are you finding that the more at-risk population then would be the seniors because they're not familiar with a lot of the tech? They might be familiar with the pressure tactics, you know, the FOMO, fear of missing out. Right. Or this is urgent, or someone's preying on emotions, right, as opposed to, you know, a clear, calm mind. But are you finding that seniors are more susceptible then to this type of illicit activity?
Well, for sure. And we have an aging demographic now. It's only going to get worse. And there's a lot of people who own homes. A lot of them have no mortgages on them. Title has been cleared. And these are the types of properties that are the targets of fraudsters. Why would they want to steal a property that has a mortgage on it when they can steal a property that is completely free? So these are, you know, definitely vulnerable people, our seniors. And I mean, it doesn't help if it's like that other case I was telling you about earlier, where it was the children actually who were the fraudsters. But we are seeing situations where adult children are concerned about the vulnerability of their aging parents when it comes to the security of their home from fraudsters.
Is there any specific pattern as to how, I mean, we've touched on a lot of various points when it comes to what real estate fraud is and what it involves, and we've talked about some red flags as well. Is there anything that really kind of sticks out in your mind, Mark, as far as the most common pattern? Or is it more specific to the target? So we're talking about elderly people that have their homes completely paid for as being the most vulnerable victims when it comes to real estate fraud. But is the only time that someone's going to find out that they've been a victim of real estate fraud when they try to transfer title or they receive notice from a third party regarding a default on a mortgage that they don't have? Is it that much of a silent crime that some of these players, you know, have gotten away with it for years and years, and it's only discovered when that asset or property has fallen into default or is being transferred? Is it like that nefarious that we could all be victim without knowing it?
Yes. I mean, there are some situations where it might not take years. For example, if the if your house, Fred, was transferred to a third party without your knowledge, one of the things that as soon as that transfer occurs, the city, the municipality becomes aware of the transfer. They're notified by MPAC, the Municipal Property Assessment Corporation. And MPAC, of course, will generate a notification to the city. And the city, when they send you a tax bill or send a tax bill to the home, will be in the name of the new owner. So you may find out within short order when you get a tax bill for your own home and it's registered to another person. So it might, you know, that's one good thing that can happen. But more often than not, it is a situation where the ID has been stolen and fake ID has been generated. Because think about it, you need that identification to produce to either a bank and to a lawyer in order to transfer the title or to register a mortgage. So everything hinges on that, the validity and the authenticity of that identification that's being produced. So as soon as that's been stolen, effectively, all kinds of hell can break loose. And it could be a while before you'd find out about it, but you'd find out with probably within a matter of months, because what happens is when you have a new a mortgage placed on your home and you don't pay for it, the bank will start sending you letters saying, hey, you know, we just put this mortgage on, and you're going to say, wait a minute, I don't even deal with that bank. When am I getting this letter? So fortunately, I would say in the vast majority of real estate transactions today in Canada are title insured. It would be a very rare instance indeed now where title insurance is not purchased. The risk, however, is that for all of those people, all those senior citizens who bought their homes back in the 50s, the 60s, and the early 70s, and the 80s, there wasn't title insurance in existence back then. So all of these homes that are completely paid for and mortgage-free are at risk for title fraud, especially if they don't have title insurance.
Would the homeowner insurance cover that?
It will not. You
know, no?
No.
That's a pretty down and out answer. They will not.
No.
Period.
It's your bag. It's your bag of problems. Yeah.
So, you know, we're talking a great deal about title insurance, obviously, for all good reasons. Just so we can be a little more specific, and I know you've touched on this before, Mark, could you explain to our listening audience the three types of title insurance and what they typically cover? And I know this may seem a little repetitive, but I think it's really important to our listeners that they understand, you know, what's available to them and what, you know, the benefit of actually having it.
So title insurance, the three of them, the purchase, like the homeowner policy and the existing homeowner policy, they're essentially the same type of policy, okay? It's just one is purchased when you're buying the home, the other policy is purchased, you know, perhaps years after you've already purchased your home. But it's the same policy coverage that it offers. The lender policy is a policy that is issued to a mortgage lender and protects the mortgage lender from the possibility that a fraudster might come along and delete their mortgage off the land, for example. Title insurance doesn't just cover fraud. It's probably one of the biggest benefits is the fraud coverage under the policy, but title insurance actually covers a homeowner and a bank from a wide variety of title defects that can exist. The primary benefit of title insurance is that it covers you for survey protection. For example, if when you bought your home, there was no survey of your property showing where the house was located on the land and where the boundaries of the property are in relation to the structures on the land, it's possible that there are structures from your neighbors that are encroaching onto your property, or structures on your land that are encroaching on your neighbor's land that you may be forced to remove down the road if the neighbor ever had a survey done and suddenly you get a letter saying, hey, your deck is 3 feet on my property, remove your deck. Well, in that type of a situation, the title insurance company will cover you for any costs associated with you being forced to remove the deck from your neighbor's property and paying to have it relocated within your lot lines. So that's one of the survey coverage is one of the biggest bangs that you get, because to get a new survey in Ontario, you're probably looking upwards of $1,500 today. So the title insurance, of course, would be less than that. And you, of course, you get the title cover, the fraud coverage. You get coverage for the possibility of any arrears of any utilities or taxes owing on the property. You get coverage for the possibility that there are any open building permits with the municipality, so that if the city ever came along and said, hey, use that example of a deck, hey, that your neighbor complained about the size of your deck, we notice that there's no permit. You never took a permit out to build that deck. You have to tear it down and rebuild it and take a permit out. Well, as long as you, the homeowner, didn't know that no permit had been taken out, then you would have your title policy would fully cover you to have that deck torn down and rebuilt with a permit. So those, there's a wide variety of other coverage under their title policy, but those are some of the primary ones and the primary benefits that you get from a title insurance policy.
Sounds really comprehensive, really, even more so than your regular homeowner policy, insurance policy, you know, with the exception of the liability claims. Bernie.
Just, I want to go back onto the deck story. If you built a deck prior to title insurance, maybe even prior to, you know, the city of Ottawa amalgamated different communities in one spot. If you never got that permission, but you overstepped your bounds and built on top of your neighbor's land, and all of a sudden they said, hey, move it, and you go through the process, are you still, if the city has no record, does that mean that it's still an invalid structure? Because, you know, if there are things that have been built in the early 1900s that might be standing, right, that might not have qualified for a permit back in the day.
Correct. So if the structure had been created before the coming into effect of the building bylaw or a zoning bylaw, then it could enjoy what's called non-conforming rights. In other words, it's grandfathered to be legal. But anything that was constructed after the coming into force of that bylaw, I think in Ottawa, it's 1964 or 1969, I can't recall now, then you need a permit for that item. But when it comes to decks, if the deck is actually affixed to the building, you definitely need a permit for that. And you also need permits where the deck has a certain height off the ground. Now, if you, as the homeowner, went ahead and built it without a permit, and you run afoul of the city or your neighbor, and then you tried to claim it under your title policy, you wouldn't have coverage because it's a defect that you yourself created. And title insurance, this is one of the exclusions under a policy, is that they don't cover you for a defect that you, the homeowner, create, or a defect that you knew about or agreed to accept. You know, if it, like, let's say when you came to buy the property, the neighbor, the homeowner that you were buying from told you, look, I built that deck myself last summer. I'm handy. I know how to do construction. And I didn't take a permit out because, you know, every time you take a permit out with the city, you know, raises your property taxes because your house is more valuable now. And you say, oh, that's great. I'm glad you didn't take a permit. I don't want to pay higher taxes. Well, now, if you go ahead and buy that property and don't, you know, insist on the permit being taken out, down the road, you may be stuck with incurring the costs if you're forced to tear it down because it's a defect that you agreed to accept and you knew about it.
Makes perfect sense. Absolutely. So is it possible to arrange for title insurance on a multi-unit residential or other commercial investment building?
Yes, certainly. So in my business, depending on the type of property that's being acquired, because it's the lawyer who actually purchases the title insurance policy for the buyer or the homeowner, we would have to contact the, you know, we'd have to find out what the nature of the property is. If it's a multi-unit, we need to know how many units are in there. And we have to obtain the required coverage from the title insurance company. And of course, if it's a commercial policy, the policies tend to be much more expensive than on a standard residential policy. In multi-unit properties, if the property contains more than three units, the lawyer is required to verify that with the city that the zoning permits that number of units and that permits have been obtained for those number of units. it's not automatic that you'll get coverage on a multi-unit property without doing some due diligence to verify with the city as to, you know, what the zoning and building provides for.
Yeah, I had a situation, right? Like this is exactly that situation where I acted on behalf of the buyer and he purchased a very nice 7-unit building in the Wurttemberg area, which is a very nice area here in Ottawa. And the lawyer at the time had done a certain amount of due diligence, but not too much, in the sense of they took a look at the property taxes and it specified right on municipal property tax bill that it was a 7-unit building. Nothing more was thought about it. Nothing more was said about it. But then what ended up happening was the requisitions that the lawyer had ordered came in, but came in after the property had closed. And after this individual was smart enough and received direction to buy title insurance. So he did, and it closed. And then probably about 5-6 weeks later, they received this notice. We don't have any, it may say on your property tax bill that it's 7 units, but we don't have a record of a building permit being taken out for unit number 7, which was in the basement. And it was a nice unit. You'd walk in, it was a nice unit. So in that particular case, he made a claim under the title insurance, which was, I mean, as a consequence of it, the title insurance company hired a contractor to come in, see what was going to be needed to legalize the unit, but still retained the right to make a decision as to how the property owner would be compensated, whether it was going to be a monetary settlement based on the number of units, or whether it was maybe less expensive to actually legalize the basement unit. And that was a process that went on for quite some time. And at the end of the day, and that choice wasn't left up to the property owner. It was strictly a decision that the title insurance company made. They decided to compensate the homeowner for the lack of, you know, the fact that it was a 6-unit, not a 7-unit. You know, and there were a lot of costs involved with that, because what they insisted on doing before making that decision, they completely gutted that lower unit, completely gutted it. I mean, took it right back to the walls just to see, okay, what are we dealing with and how can this be remedied? So I can't, you know, stress enough to our listeners how important this is. Like, it really is very, very important.
Look, title insurance isn't the be all and end all. And, you know, sure, you could say I'm going to get a policy and it will cover me for, you know, the possibility that I'm going to have an illegal unit. But once you're put in that situation of having to make a claim, it could be, you could be forced to evict a tenant. You could be faced with all kinds of delays and costs that are not always compensated fully. Then had you done the due diligence right up front, or had your lawyer do the due diligence up front to verify that everything was copacetic with the city. We also see situations where the MLS system will say, the zoning for this property is R4. It permits a fourplex. Okay, for you're allowed in this neighborhood to have 4 units. People seem to rely and think that, the zoning allows 4 units. This property has 4 units. It's legal. Well, no, the property may only have building permits for 2 units. So although the neighborhood allows for 4,
exactly,
this particular property is only legal for 2. And so you got a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. That is a great point. So listeners, I'd almost recommend you back up the podcast 30 seconds and listen to that again, because that is a very, very important point. Just because it's zoned a particular way does not mean that you can automatically, or that it is what it's zoned for. So pay attention, listeners. Bernie.
How does insurance companies treat that? If let's say you had a 7-unit place, right, and you're a commercial operator, and you're going, hi, I've got a 7-unit here, cover me for my asset. Will the insurance company go, you know what, your title insurance, the city planning, you know, you didn't get all your paperwork in alignment, you're not covered. Is that a potential?
The title insurance companies have certain criteria in for multi-unit properties and commercial properties that must be satisfied in order to get the required coverage. So the lawyer has to go through a checklist, basically, to make sure what's covered, what's not covered. There's also riders that can be purchased for additional sums to get certain coverage. A title insurance company might also say, we'll give you the basic coverage that we'll give you, but we're going to exclude a particular defect that is known. Okay. And we're not going to cover you for that seventh unit because you knew about it, that type of thing. So as I indicated, it's not, title insurance is a tool. It's great for fraud coverage, but when it comes to the legality of the property to meet city zoning and building and fire codes, these are things that it really behooves a homeowner to make sure the lawyer does the required due diligence to make sure the property meets all the required elements for compliance. Because as I indicated, if you don't, you might get, even if you have coverage, the hassle that you're going to, you may go through just making the claim, it may not be worth it. You know, that you should have from the outset made sure everything was copacetic.
So would this also affect if you're getting property insurance, not title insurance, but property insurance for fire theft or, you know, accidental falls, et cetera, would that also influence or impact that insurance coverage too?
It can, because don't forget, insurance typically covers you for sudden and unknown risks. Okay, that's what insurance is designed to protect you for. If you're going to store gallons of gasoline in your garage, thinking that if a fire occurs in your garage or it explodes because of it, you know, and you didn't tell the insurance company that you were storing gasoline in your garage, you're not going to be covered because you're creating a risk. It's a known risk, and that's not what insurance is designed to cover. And there's a very high level of disclosure that a homeowner has and good faith that a homeowner has in dealing with your insurance company to fully disclose known risks.
Great point. Good point. As we're drawing to a close here, I just want to take a moment and suggest what, how we'll finish up is let's give our listeners some golden rules relating to real estate investments. And this is just really meant to be a, you know, an open discussion, but I think it's really kind of important that we summarize or bring to the attention of our listeners some of the things they need to watch out for. So, Mark, why don't you start us off?
Well, we talked about one of them, that if it sounds too good to be true, it probably is.
Yeah.
That a high level of skepticism is a healthy thing to have when you're going to part with your dearest asset, which is your money or your real estate.
Absolutely. And when we talk about too good to be true, that's someone, a promoter coming to you and offering you, you know, a 20% return in 6 months or a year, something that's really out of the ordinary. I mean, sure, all you hear is 20%. You don't necessarily consider, or many people wouldn't necessarily consider, well, where's this 20% coming from? But as we all know, and we've read and listened to all sorts of negative publicity revolving around what essentially is a pyramid scheme, where a promoter will take your money and use it to pay off a present or ongoing liability rather than investing it in the scheme or the real estate property that they promised you.
Well, one thing that I've found, I've had some clients who lend money on mortgages, Fred. They live in Ottawa and they're presented with lending money on a property somewhere up in, Sault Ste. Marie, a first or a second mortgage on a property in another jurisdiction. They're not able to go to the property to look at it. They're relying upon the information that's being provided to them by either the borrower or the broker or the realtor. And there's risk associated with that. You know, you don't know what that property has. You haven't seen it. You're not familiar with that market. And then let's see a situation where that borrower doesn't pay the mortgage. And now you're forced to repossess the property and you're going to have to kind of go up there, manage that property, perhaps list it for sale and deal with a situation that you're not entirely familiar with. So if you can't see it or touch it, my advice is to stay away from it.
Yeah, and I wholeheartedly agree with that, Mark. I mean, I know it's not necessarily, Not everyone agrees with that approach, but at the end of the day, it's so true. I tell people, rather than investing in things that are like aren't tangible, I mean, I always say, go see the property, go see the building, go understand it, know what it is before parting with one red cent.
Got a question, Mark. We're talking about properties here in like in our own backyard or in our province, nationally or internationally, whether you're, you know, your money coming in from the outside world and they say outside of the country coming in to invest, whether it's a commercial asset or it's multi-unit residential. Or I want to go, let's say, somewhere to the States or Mexico or Europe and I want to invest there. What should I be aware of other than maybe I should have an international lawyer or a lawyer in that country?
Well, in all likelihood, you're going to need a lawyer in that jurisdiction. If you're buying a property in, let's say you're in Ontario or in Ottawa and you're looking to buy a property in Sudbury, for example, you could use a lawyer in Ottawa to do that transaction. But my advice would be you're better served by using a lawyer in that jurisdiction where the land is located. Only because the local regulations, the bylaws, the zoning could be very different than what we're dealing with here in Ottawa. And so you'd be better served by using a local lawyer. If you're investing in a foreign jurisdiction, you should research out, you know, from friends, family, and others who a good lawyer would be to use in that jurisdiction. I bought a property in Mexico several years ago, and we had to use a notary and a local real estate agent. So we asked around and we were able to successfully complete the transaction, you know, because we had done our due diligence when it came to using somebody who had a good track record.
And something that a lot of people, and this brings me to another point, you know, a lot of people while they're on vacation will turn around and consider investing or buying timeshares. And to that, I would very strongly suggest that you do not succumb to high pressure sales tactics, because I know you're there and it's a beautiful time, but the fine print on some of these documents is just amazingly prejudiced against the participant or the person that's buying the timeshare. And case in point, take a look at what's just in the news. Wasn't there a couple that were arrested after failing to fulfill the requirements of a timeshare purchase? And where was that? Does anybody know? Costa Rica?
They're an American couple, if I'm not mistaken, and one of the Latin American countries.
Yeah.
One of them. Okay. All right. Fair enough. That'll go unnamed because you never know. You may go there on holidays and be thrown into the kink. Yeah. So, which brings us to another point. And these, again, we've kind of discussed off recording. But another point that I'd like to make is that you should stay away from unsolicited real estate offers when you don't know the individual, when you don't know where it's coming from. But all of a sudden, I mean, the worst one is, well, a friend of a friend of mine is putting this together or doing that. So stay away from those type of unsolicited real estate offers. Anything else?
Of course, make sure you read the fine print. If you don't understand it, make sure you speak to somebody who can explain it properly. Don't give in to high pressure tactics and, do your due diligence.
Yeah, of course. Know the person that's making the offering and understand the offering and know the people that you're going to be involved with. I mean, don't be shy about that. I mean, at the end of the day, it's your funds. And if someone is asking you to part with those funds, and you know, we're very strong advocates of real estate investing, but for whatever reason, be very, very cautious.
I think one of the things also to add to the overall structure is that if someone says, hey, I got an opportunity. Okay, that's great. Usually you're working with a team. Right, you'll have an accountant. You'll have a legal representation, maybe a mortgage broker. I would suggest that you capitalize on the team. That way, if someone's pressuring you or playing on your emotions to trigger on something, leverage your team because your team will go and they'll probably slow things down or become part of the vetting cycle, right? Doing the due diligence.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely. That's investing 101. We spend a great deal of time discussing just that point about creating and developing your team of trusted advisors, people that can guide you through the process of not just purchasing investment real estate, but actually managing it as well. You know, and I believe, you know, in the course, you'll see an awful lot of time dedicated just to that point. So, and you can start on that at any time, I mean, you don't have to own real estate to develop that team. So keep that in mind. And as Mark, you know, very well pointed out, and Bernie, you've brought it up as well, have it vetted. You know, discover who the people are that are promoting and the people that you're going to be involved with. So great point. Anything else?
Well, Fred, funny you should ask that question. If someone is listening to this podcast and they want to know, well, where is this course? Where is this course, Fred?
Oh, you can access it from just about any online search mechanism. Look for Gentry Learning. Visit our website. Everything that you need to know about the courses is there. So, you know, based on the comments of people that have taken the course, I think it's well worthwhile, and it is very inexpensive to take as well. So check out gentryres.com or gentrylearning.com, and you'll see the complete suite of available courses. Very easy to sign up. But good point. Thanks for bringing that up, Bernie. So this kind of brings us to the end of our question and answers, but Mark, we've got some rapid fire Q&As. So, Mark, what are you reading right now?
Well, my partner just gave me a book by Mel Robbins called The Let Them Theory. It's a self-help book and quite interesting. It's a method that teaches you how to protect your time and energy and focus on what matters to you.
Great. Bernie.
So, Mark, do you have a favorite book of all time?
Well, I had Art of the Deal on my top of my list for the longest time, but it's I think I burned it.
Firewood. It's firewood. It came from Canada anyhow.
Yeah. Okay, well, do you have a second favorite book?
I think the Bible at this point.
All right, okay, let's shift gears here a bit. What's your favorite meal?
Ooh, that's a good one. I'm going to toss up between a good rack of lamb and a nice juicy steak. I'm a meat and potatoes kind of guy.
There you go. That's good healthy living right there. Bernie.
Do you have a favorite beverage? Are you a wine connoisseur or a scotch aficionado?
I used to like single malt scotch, but I've drifted from that. I'm a Jameson whiskey now guy.
Really?
Yep.
Boy, that's... Now, do you mix that or you drink it straight?
No, that's straight. It's on the rocks.
Really?
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't think I could take that leap from single malt to Jameson's. I mean, you know, Jameson's okay, but I always kind of considered it a bar, you know, bar rye. But anyways, yeah, okay. Well, good for you. So tell me, describe your perfect day.
My perfect day? It does not involve anything that looks white, where there's white outside. It's a sunny day. There's a beach nearby with some gently rolling waves. That's my perfect day.
Yeah.
Well, that would kind of lead us into the next question. What perhaps could be your most favorite place to be in the world?
Well, I haven't been to a lot of places in the world. I do love Mexico. I've spent a lot of time there. I've owned a property there. My daughter lives there and my grandchildren. So I have a lot of time for Mexico. I think it's a beautiful culture, despite all of the problems that it has with cartels and whatnot. I think for the most part, it's a beautiful place and the beautiful people.
And to finish things up, this very important question. What's your favorite type of ice cream?
I got to go with chocolate peanut butter.
Chocolate peanut butter. Well, that's a first. I don't know. I kind of thought that maybe, you know, you were a little bit of a traditionalist, like butter pecan or rum raisin or Neapolitan. No. Isn't that interesting? And where do you get that? Is that a...
No, I love the Baskin Robbins. It's one of my favorites. Yep.
Good for you. All right. Well, Mark, Thank you so very much for agreeing to be our guest again today. This has been an incredibly informative, and I'm sure all our wizards out there are really going to lap this up. If they would like to get a hold of you, what's the best way for them to do it?
Well, they can certainly reach me by email. My email address is mark, M-A-R-K, at markhabiblawyers.com. Lawyers is plural. You can also reach me through our website, which is www.markhabiblawyers or Habib and Associates. You can find us through that. And my cell phone number, my office number, which you can reach me at any time. My calls get forwarded directly to my cell phone. The number is 613-820-8888, extension 1.
And you've had that number forever. It's one of the few that I know off my heart. Because today, ask anybody for the number to their sister or their brother or a family member, chances are they don't know it because they're just pressing it on their iPhone. Now, we're not going to quite let you off the hook yet, Mark. So I think you may have done this for us before. We always ask our guest to explain to our listeners what a term or a word means. And in this particular case, we would like you to explain to our listeners what statute of frauds is referencing.
It's time for the Property Wizard's Word of the Day.
The statutes of frauds is basically an old English law that has since been passed down to most common law countries. And what the statute of law of frauds provides for is that any dealings with land, any contracts for the sale or purchase of land must be in writing. That is what the statute of frauds essentially states. It doesn't have to do with fraud in the context of what we've been discussing today, although it relates to it tangentially, but effectively it requires agreements dealing with land to be in writing because, of course, you can have a verbal contract, but when it comes to land, very risky, and there's so many potential pitfalls that you don't want it to be in a verbal agreement. It would almost be impossible to itemize everything in a verbal understanding. So it must be in writing.
Yeah, absolutely. Great advice again. Only makes sense.
Yeah.
Only makes sense. It has to be in writing. That's why, as a real estate broker or us dealing with a trade in real estate, if someone gives you a verbal offer on a property, whether it's an investment or a home, it's really not worth anything because they can't be held to it.
Right.
And that's primarily because outside of, not getting into the discussion about contract law and everything else, this is dealing specifically with real estate, a transfer of interest in real estate. And it isn't worth anything. So don't take anything someone says verbally when it comes to a transfer or an interest in a piece of property.
Yeah. And on that point, Fred, most standard form contracts that deal with the sale of land also have a specific provision in it that says that unless it's in the contract, it's not part of the contract. So any representations, promises, anything verbal that was discussed, if it doesn't make it into the contract, it's not part of the contract.
Yeah. Again, good point. If it's not written down, folks, don't believe what you're hearing. Yeah. Bernie, anything to add?
This has been a great discussion, and it just drives home the points of don't be in a rush, get sound advice from another party. So the first thing that comes knocking on your door doesn't mean you have to pick it up and play with it. Or spend money on it. More importantly, spend money on it and take the necessary precautions to protect what you have. Whether it's the title insurance, maybe even having a mortgage running still, even for a nominal fee might be a good thing because the lender will want to protect their asset too. So it's more of a team. It's just, a kind of a subtle thought on that.
Yeah, definitely. And just one last point. If you have any listeners who are thinking about making an investment in real estate, a lot of times by the time we get the clients, they've already done the deal, and it's too late for us to make any changes to anything. It's never too soon to contact your lawyer about a deal that you're thinking of doing. we can always provide some guidance and some input into a pending transaction, and even before the agreement is drafted or before you've even made a decision about buying something.
Yeah, when we deal with co-tenancies, we insist we give everyone the co-tenancy agreement well in advance. And we insist that what they do is they go to their lawyer and get independent legal advice on the contract itself.
Yes.
So we have, for instance, the one that we use for our co-tenancies is pretty specific, and it has basically passed the mustard, you know, scores of times, because we've had a lot of legalized look at it. And it's a very well-crafted document, but at the end of the day, it's inherently fair to all participants.
Right. And
therein lies the difference between maybe a timeshare document and a co-tenancy document. Do not confuse the two. They are not the same. Thank you very much, Mark. Again, you want to sign us off, Bernie?
Absolutely. So if you have questions about anything we've talked about today or about the course, reach out to us at info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. And of course, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities. Thank you, wizards. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to Fred and Bernie on another edition of The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentrylearning.com. Remember to like and leave us a comment and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode of The Property Wizard.